own time, February 22nd, 1970. In what I have listened here before, and in what I have spoken, there are certain assumptions that should be kept in mind. I have referred to them in that way, and also in the philosophy of consciousness without mind. But here I try to speak more fully concerning two points. For instance, I generally avoid the use of the word mind, and also the word spirit or spiritual, and to some extent the word psychical and second. For the reason that these words have quite different meanings in the different usages we find in literature. And unless one clarifies his position, it can lead to a misconception when the terms are so used. Present the problem in connection with the word mind. I'll read a few pages out of the commentary of Dr. Carl G. Jung. In the commentary, he connected with the Tibetan book of the Great Liberation, material that is associated with a Tibetan known as Padma Sambhava. In this psychological statement, we have the following. Dr. Evan Zen has entrusted me with the task of commenting on a text which contains an important exposition of Eastern psychology. The very fact that I have to use inverted commas around the word psychology shows the dubious applicability of this term. It is perhaps not superfluous to mention that the East has produced nothing equivalent to what we call psychology, but rather philosophy and metaphysics. Critical philosophy, the mother of modern psychology, is as foreign to the East as to medieval Europe. Thus the word mind, as used in the East, has the connotation of something metaphysical. Our Western conception of mind has lost this connotation since the Middle Ages, and the word has now come to signify a psychic function. Despite the fact that we neither know nor pretend to know what psychic is, we can deal with the phenomenon of mind. We do not assume that the mind is a metaphysical entity, or that there is any connection between an individual mind and a hypothetical universal mind. Our psychology is therefore a science of mere phenomena without any metaphysical implications. The development of Western philosophy during the last 2 centuries has succeeded in isolating the mind in its its own spirit, and in severing it from its primordial oneness with the universe, man himself has ceased to be the microcosm, the idolon of the cosmos, and Nirvana is no longer the consubstantial scintilla or spot of the anima mundi, the very soul. Psychology accordingly treats all metaphysical claims and assertions as mental phenomena, and regards them as statements about the mind and its structure that derive ultimately from certain unconscious dispositions. It does not consider them to be absolutely valid or even capable of establishing a metaphysical truth. We have no intellectual means of ascertaining whether this attitude is right or wrong. We only know that there is no evidence for and no possibility of proving the validity of a metaphysical posture such as universal mind. If the mind asserts the existence of the universal mind, we hold that it is merely making an assertion. We do not assume that by such an assertion, the existence of the universal mind has been established. There is no argument against this meaning, but no evidence here that our conclusion is ultimately right. In other words, it is just as possible that our mind is nothing but a perceptible manifestation of the universal mind. Yet we do not know, and we cannot even see, how it would be possible to recognize whether this is so or not. Psychology therefore holds that the mind cannot establish or assert anything beyond itself. If then we accept the restrictions imposed upon the capacity of our mind, we demonstrate our common sense. I admit it is something of a sacrifice, inasmuch as we bid farewell to that miraculous road in which mind created things and beings move to find it. This is the world of the kingdom, where even inanimate objects are endowed with a living, healing, magic power, through which they participate in us and these in them. Sooner or later, we had to understand that their potency was really ours, and that their significance was ours. The theory of knowledge is only the last step out of humanity's garden, out of a world where mind-created figures populated the metaphysical heaven and hell. Despite this inevitable epistemological criticism, however, we have held fast to the religious faith that the origin of faith enables man to know God. The West thus developed a new belief, the conflict between Christ and religion. The critical philosopher of science became, as it were, negatively metaphysical. In other words, materialistic, on the basis of an error in judgment. Matter was assumed to be a tangible and recognizable reality. Yet this is a thoroughly metaphysical concept, apostatized by uncritical minds. Matter is an hypothesis. When you say matter, you are really creating a symbol or something unknown. It may be just as well still as anything else. it may even be God. Religious faith, on the other hand, refuses to give up its three principles, both from Christ. In contradiction to the saying of Christ, the faithful try to remain children instead of becoming as children. They cling to the world of childhood. A famous modern theologian confesses in his autobiography that Jesus has turned the scripture from childhood on. Jesus is the perfect example of a man who preached something different from the religion of his forefathers. But the Immortatio Christi does not appear to include the mental and spiritual sacrifice which he had to undergo at the beginning of his career, and without which he would never have become a savior. The conflict between science and religion is, in reality, a misunderstanding of both. Scientific materialism has merely introduced a new apostasy, and that is an intellectual truth. It has given another name to the supreme principle of reality, and has assumed that this creates a new thing and discards an old thing. Who do you call the principle of existence? God, matter, energy, or anything else you like? You have created nothing. You admit you have simply changed a symbol. The materialist is a metaphysician, Marjorie Lewis. Faith, on the other hand, tries to maintain a primitive mental condition on mere fundamental grounds. It is unknown to give up the primitive childlike relationship, the mind field, and apostatized thinking. It wants to go on enjoying the security and confidence of a world still presided over by powerful, responsible, and kindly souls. Faith may include a sacrificial intellectual, provided there is an intellectual sacrifice. But certainly, not a sacrifice of feeling. In this way, the faithful remain children instead of becoming children. And they do not bring their life because they have not lost it. Furthermore, faithful life is done, and thus this is deserved. For it refuses to share in the spiritual adventure of our age. Any honest thinker has to admit the insecurity of all metaphysical traditions, and in particular, of all beliefs. He has also to admit the unwarrantable nature of all metaphysical traditions, and based the fact that there is no evidence whatever for the ability of the human mind to pull itself up by its own bootstraps, that is, to establish anything transcendental. Materialism is a metaphysical reaction against the suddenly resulting by cognition through the mental process, and the carry beyond the human plane, a projection. The reaction arises in metaphysics insofar as the man of average philosophical education barely sees through the implied apostasy, not realizing that matter is just another name for the supreme principle. And against it, the attitude of faith shows how reluctant people were to accept philosophical citizens. It also demonstrates how great is the fear of letting go one hold on the securities of power and of dropping into a strange, unknown world ruled by forces unconcerned with man. Nothing really changes in either case. Man and his surroundings remain in either case. He has only to realize that he is shut up inside his mind and cannot step beyond it, even in insanity. And that the appearance of his will or of his God very much depends upon his own mental condition. In the first place, the structure of the mind is responsible for anything we may assert about metaphysical matters, as I have already pointed out. We have also begun to understand that the intellect is not an end per se, or a thing like that, or an independent mental faculty, but a psychic function dependent upon the conditions of the psyche as a whole. A philosophical statement is the product of a certain personality, living at a certain time, in a certain place, and not the outcome of a purely logical and impersonal procedure. To that extent, it is future subjective. Whether it has an objective validity or not depends upon whether there are few or many persons who argue in the same way. The isolation of man within his mind as a result of epistemological criticism has naturally led to psychological criticism. This kind of criticism is not popular to the philosopher, since they like to consider the philosophic intellect as the perfect and unconditioned instrument of philosophy. Yet this intellect of today is a function depending upon an individual psyche and determined on all sides by subjective conditions, right apart from environmental influences. Indeed, we have already become so accustomed to this point of view, the mind has lost its universal character altogether. It has become a more or less individualized affair, with no trace of its former cosmic aspect, as the anima rationale. Mind is understood nowadays as a subjective, even an arbitrary thing. Now that the formerly hypothesized universal ideas have turned out to be mental principles, it is dawning upon us to what extent our whole experience of so-called reality is psychic. As a matter of fact, everything thought, felt, or perceived is a psychic image, and the world itself exists only so far as we are able to produce an image of it. We are so deeply impressed with the truth of our imprisonment in and limitation by the psyche that we are ready to admit the existence in it, even of things we do not know. We call them the unconscious. The seemingly universal and metaphysical scope of the mind has thus been narrowed down to the small circle of individual consciousness, profoundly aware of its almost limitless objectivity and of its infantile archaic tendency, the deepest projection and divinity. Many scientifically minded persons have even sacrificed their religious philosophic meaning for fear of uncontrolled subjectivity. By way of compensation for the loss of a world that pulsed without breath and breathed without breath, we have developed an enthusiasm for facts. Mountains of facts far beyond any single individual's power to survive. We have the pious hope that this incidental accumulation of facts will form a meaningful whole. But nobody is quite sure, because no human brain can possibly comprehend the gigantic sum total of this mass-produced knowledge. But that's barrier. But whoever dares to touch it must pay for it to the past country. And write it down, for he will instantly be picked up by the fact. Western psychology knows the mind as the mental function of a psychic. It is the mentality of an individual. An impersonal, universal mind is still to be met in the sphere of philosophy, where it seems to be a relic of the original human soul. This picture of our Western outlook may seem a little drastic, but I do not think that it is far from the truth. At all events, something of the kind presents itself as soon as we are confronted with the Eastern mentality. In the East, mind is a cosmic factor, the very essence of existence. While in the West, we have just begun to understand that it is the essential cognition of cognition, and hence of the cognitive existence of the world. There is no conflict between religion and science in the East, because no science is there based upon the passion for fact, and no religion upon mere faith. There is religious cognition and cognitive religion. Without man is incommensurably small, and the grace of God is everything. But in the East, man is God, and he is deep in Christ. The gods of Tibetan Buddhism belong to the sphere of illusory justice, and mind is the creative progression. And yet, there exists. But so far as we are concerned, an illusion remains an illusion. And thus is nothing at all. It is a paradox, yet nevertheless true, that without a thought has no proper reality. We treat it as if it were a nothingness. Even though the thought be true in itself, we hold that it exists only by virtue of certain factors which it is said to form it. We can produce a most devastating fact like the atom bomb with the help of this ever-changing phantasmagoric, a virtual, non-existent thought. But it seems wholly absurd that one could ever establish the reality of thought, this thought. What I think, what is wrong? A very fair statement of the most sophisticated Western understanding. It is not popularly understood that having had a college education with no guarantee that one has this understanding of the nature of mind as understood by the West. Only those who are grounded in the story of philosophy, poetry, and in depth of poetry. And I've actually seen what has happened in the history of thought. Really appreciate these facts that have been brought out by Dr. Young. Now in my writing and thinking and speaking, I always have in mind this ultimate Western point of view. I attempt speaking to Western life in the most sophisticated understanding. In my way, I became aware of this problem way back as a student in the college. And it seemed to me that the resolution of the problem might lie in the determination that there existed other ways of cognition than those of sense perception and conceptual cognition. Ultimately, the result of that search was positive. So let us look at our problem. One was familiar the physical philosophy, and that means the philosophy of memory, and that the young man who has developed in his pursuit of pure reason, then too, the influence of that philosophy on the thinking of Dr. Young. In fact, he read the book when he was only 17 years old, and in the 6 centuries away between the fountain and the moon. Immanuel Kant emerges as actually the critical figure in all Western thought. One appreciates his position in this Western thought. One must return to the story of the art philosophy. I think it is rather significant that the man who stands as the dividing point between the scholasticism of the Middle Ages brought to us the treasure of ancient Greek thought. The man who stands as the physical fence between that and modern philosophy, science, and psychology is René Descartes. And it may be significant that he stands as the first in the field of modern mathematics as well as the first in the field of modern philosophy. This philosophy was colored very deeply by his mathematical rigor. Philosophy became conditioned fundamentally by mathematical thought. Rigor and the whole school a philosopher founded by them, of which there are four members, three beside himself, who stand out as great. There is the great German mathematician and philosopher Leibniz, who second in the line, the last man who was said to know everything that was to be known. Spinoza, who wrote his greatest work in a form analogous to that of geometry. and finally Christian Bohr, whose philosophic writings have dominated the thinking of the younger and younger time. But there was no criticism in this thing. It seemed to imply that the system of conception was essentially identical with real existence. There then developed in the British Isles a concept in philosophical schools which is known as skepticism or radical empiricism. The earliest figure was that of Francis Bacon, but the one who developed more sophisticated for this point of view was John Locke. He pointed out that the older faculty of psychology led to certain rather ridiculous consequences. The old faculty of psychology of this day was when one thinks it is the faculty of music, that thing. The patient which really doesn't have too much meaning. It's not I, the music, the faculty of music. He pointed out that our ideas must have a reference to an existence which is extinct, to be about. So a thing. He predicated that the mind of a newborn child is an empty pocket, as Pavlov writes, in which there was no discernment whatsoever, but that experience wrote upon that pocket all that became knowledge, lived in the other. He assumed, however, that there was a substance behind things, and that there was a substance behind mind. Many who followed him with no reason, this is doctrine, who saw that the conception of a substance behind things really had no necessary place. The substance is not something that is extinct. It does was a dedication by John Locke that it existed without any basis in experience to justify to a something not to exist. Locke suggested that in place of things, of a substance behind things, that all things could be, but the idea planted in the mind by God. And thus was founded what is known to him as subjective ideas. But the third or fourth great figure among the empiricists was David Hume, the Scotsman. And he pointed out that there is no real ground of assuming a substance behind ideas, such as that. And you realize that, and this is a particular logical development, you arrive at the condition that all which exists is simply a mind, a manifest impression and ideas. It gives us no assurance of anything whatsoever. We point out that even though we see the sunrise a million times, and gives us no assurance that the sun would rise tomorrow. But the impact of David Hume upon the man of time, which he said, awoke him from his dogmatic slumber, a philosophical thing. Here we are, the one stream of philosophy that led to a rather arbitrary dogmatism, and another stream of philosophy that led to an absolute skepticism. Both of them proving to be blind allies. The way out of this blind or deep blind allies was recorded by a thought of the man of time. That's what the reason was. He was such an important figure in the whole history of life. A man that must be understood if we are to understand science. If we are taught to understand the Western man. Now there's one thing overlooked by the imperial. When we arrive at the final conclusion of radical imperialism, as in David Hume, we arrive at a position where mathematics would be impossible. Northrop, when he was the beginning of the East and the West, makes the point that an effort has been made to derive mathematics from an assumed basis of knowledge, such as the which we are left by David Hume, and it cannot be done. Not buried upon the significance of the question that Immanuel Kant asked toward the close of his introduction to the Critique of Pure Reason, how to assure mathematics possible. That it exists is unquestionable. Without pure mathematics, there could not be an applied mathematics. And without applied mathematics, there could not be modern technology. There could not be the machine. There could not be modern transportation. There could not be a trip to the moon without applied mathematics. But the machine and the machine, the medical science, transportation and otherwise, is a fact of extent today. Therefore, we know that applied mathematics exists, since without this applied mathematics, these modern achievements of the machine would be impossible. And then the applied mathematics is a result of the delving by the pure mathematician in the rising power. Therefore, pure mathematics is good. We have a fact, therefore, to establish, even from the imperial state, that it is not explainable by imperialism. Not me, definitely. That then shows how important was this question of Immanuel Kant. A question which I find Jung has not recognized in its bearing. The Jung proof to the radical imperialism, optimism in a different field. But he finds the solution of the problems of Bayesian men, primarily in irrational factors, whereas mathematics is supremely rational. Is there then a rational base as well as material. All experience as experience, a qua experience, is irrational. In the sense that it is not in the process of reason. Not necessarily in the sense of being against reason. What do you mean here may be illustrated in the following way. A man born blind is sufficiently intelligent and sane to grasp the physicist's conception of life as a complex of wave systems and a particle, which can be mathematically formulated. He could, for instance, conceive or make the statement and understand logically its meaning that a given monochromatic beam of light, say, the color red, had involved a certain wave system, a certain amplitude, and certain velocity. And that it was in some sense an actual particle physical. The one thing he would not have is the immediate experience of the monochromatic red corresponding to that. He would have to have sight in order to have this immediate experience of red. This brings out a point. The perceptual perception and rational cognition are two different orders of consciousness. But one does not leap into the other. But that there is an incremental relationship between the two. Our assumed man born blind to grasp the conceptual image of life could not from that make the cross over into the direct experience of life, as the monochromatic world he refers to. There is thus between the conceptual cognition and the perceptual cognition, or sense perception, a high thing. An incommensurability, or a point of this continuity. You're familiar with this fact. An applied mathematics, as distinct from pure mathematics, manages to make the crossing from pure conceptuality to affecting consequences in the perceptual zone. Namely, the things we do right, but they do perceptually exist in form. Now, where does the pure mathematics come from? As a myth, the man brings it with when he is born. It is not derived from perceptual experience. It comes out of conceptual capacity. benefit. These words are tied in to something that is beyond the screen. I have suggested before that you are not enough to see the other of your metaphysics. Just as most conceptions which are experience-oriented may be regarded as the other of sense experience. Pointed out that there is an area of this room between unconceptual and conceptual cognition. Let us forget that there is a similar distinction between film tonight and pure metaphysics. But that they are capable of a parallel mind and in fact they can use it, and I will parallel using the scene. These are the objective powers we can develop far in the range of pure mathematical concepts. We may start with simple conceptions, numbers that do not say numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. And we can correlate it with perceptual entities such as fingers and toes, or stones of any concept. Now, correlations made long ago are primitive. I'm not, however, we develop number conceptions that become ultimately extremely sophisticated. The conception of the past, the conception of the musical mind, of the imaginary mind, of the transcendental mind, of the sky and the evil are the most familiar concepts. And of transcendental, which are extremely subtle. There are those who view such development as ancient, a purely formal, and without meaning. But what I am suggesting is this, that they are parallel in the mind of a medical, a pure metaphysical reality, which is ultimately what these conceptions mean. Well, I do not know whether what I'm leading to will get right. But it is this. What is not strictly true to base everything on pure experience either in the sense of being or in the sense of that we want. But that he had another capacity. That reduces, first of all, effect within the world of experience, although it is not derived from experience. And therefore, by it we have a rational life that can lead into that realm that generally is hidden from us, in the sense of recalling the collective unconscious. And that here we do have, in our mental resources, a way that it has never been like, which leads to the beyond. Now let us return to our original topic. Why do I, for instance, not use the word mind? Because of its ambiguity, of its connotation. You read the word in Oriental literature as a thing, a relationship to a universal mind. It is here, not to you, that would be implied by any really important question. But you mean something quite different, as you want to find it out from the Jesus relationship. And again, think of you in philosophical literature. It's divided into two parts. One part of it is called Kama-manas, and the other Paras-manas. Kama-manas can be translated desire-manas. And mentation, that is led by wisdom. There is wisdom, and that obviously is what is meant by Kama-manas. There is some reason maintaining that wisdom thinking is the only kind of thinking there is. But we might tie in higher mind, higher mind, with the conceptions of discernment, discrimination, and judgment. Processes that certainly are capable of functioning in the consideration of the eye. And they do so function in the field of pure mathematics. That is a just proven fact. So, when you translate mind as money or as mana money, there is an ambiguity. For the more we come to the usage of free or abundance, we translate manas as sense mind, as the ruling power, the king of sensuous cognition, and uses the term Buddha to represent the pure reason. Again, the term in the use of terms that is quite different from that of the theosophical literature, where Buddha is translated as spiritual soul. How do you avoid getting into a lot of misunderstandings and getting down to some confusion and formulation? I just avoid using the word mind without a lot of preliminary statements and terms, and instead use these conceptions. Sensuous cognition or perception. Conceptual cognition. And then introduce as the third function a name, introception or introceptual cognition. concept of cognition thus occupies an intermediate position between sense perception and introspective cognition, which would be the organ, faculty, or function by which metaphysical truth may be known. The latter term, the latter conception, is not to be found in general philosophical literature. General philosophical literature and psychology deals with perceptual functions and conceptual functions. Just these two forms of cognition. The complete has been the thorough analysis to which these two forms have been submitted have not shown any door to the transcendent. And that criticism, I think, is valid. It doesn't enable us to either affirm that the transcendent is, or that it is not. With those two functions alone, we simply do not know. We cannot know that there is any existence beyond our psychical images at all. We are locked in. What I submit is that introspective cognition opens the door to that door. And that's what it's about. But this would not be important if this was merely a speculative idea, an idea that I invented. That would be merely a more or less clever exercise. It is grounded, however, upon certain realizations. And I submit that realization represents a function, faculty, or organ by which one may open doors of consciousness which normally remains closed. I've had, as I pointed out before, five such realizations in emerging theories, of which the two last were most important. And the last, the very last, of two permanent importance, since it involved in me a philosophical revolution, whereas the other four have not been so radical in their impact. And that through these realizations, I have experienced the cognitive form, which is neither perceptual cognition nor conceptual cognition. And I invented the term of perception to represent this form of cognition. And it was defined as the power whereby the light of consciousness turns upon itself or distorts. The light of consciousness being the cognitive factor in consciousness. We have then three forms. And you bear in mind, I do not assert that introspection is a simple function. It may be a complex function. But its division into complexity is not wholly clear, and so I leave it as a as a group term in which there may be possible forms. It certainly would include rather than the meaning by the truth of consciousness. But it may trouble more that he has differentiated in the people. What is the case interpreted as standing above conceptual cognition in the same way that perceptual cognition stands below conceptual cognition? And the connecting link between the two is conceptual cognition. How we can identify different forms of cognition corresponding to these three functions. Perceptual cognition is simple sense perception. And it is said to correspond to samsara. It gives us phenomena. And samsara, we will identify it with the whole domain of phenomena. Appearances be for us as objects. Whether subtle or gross. Now let us get to interceptional cognition. There are two phases identifiable in this place. One is cognition as assurance. Assurance is the outstanding characteristic of that realization which is described as arising above space, time, and law, and which tends to identify itself with Nirvana. The assurance did not produce a system of ideas. It produced the effect that all is well, that the problem, the bigger one in the life, are here resolved, that my home continuity as a consciousness entity is certain, and that the problems of bigger one in life either disappear or are resolved in forms of essential transcendence ideas. Also, and this is applied to that state of the higher being. It was the realization of a pure self-existent consciousness, which is not derivative, which is not simply a relationship between subject and object, but is the source of the self, or itself, and of all possible objects whatsoever, so that all images are functions of that consciousness, instead of the consciousness being viewed as a function of an entity. There are means conceptual cognition. But first I was inclined to identify more or less with the sensoric as well as identifying perceptual cognition or sense images to the sensoric. But that doesn't seem to be its true function. It rather corresponds to that which in Sanskrit is called the antastara, that which bridges between. Conceptual cognition gives us everything that makes possible language, possible communication, possible formation that can be translated into outer form of perception. The correlation with the sensuous world is something that's quite familiar. But it also serves as a bridging element to the world of the interceptual order. But this bridging is accomplished by a different form. Whereas the initiative with respect to the perceptual order primarily arises in the conceptual order, and we step from a conceptual idea to the production of a sympathetic system with mind machine. The mind in its relationship or the conceptual cognitive function in its relationship to the interception acts as responsive, and it thinks in terms of transcriptive conceptions. But the relationship to the interceptive order is like that of toward an impregnating essence. It's injected into the conceptual cognitive function producing ideas or conceptions. This part, this similarly follows the parallel of the relationship in biology, an impregnating force and a bodybuilding power. The mind in this case performs the feminine function of building not physical bodies, but conceptual systems. Now here we have a tie-in with the domain above. Whoever used words like mind and spirit and so forth, people could have a misunderstanding because of the ambiguity involved in these words. But here we have a certain degree of precision. If we think of perceptual cognition as giving us phenomena which correspond to sanskara, that conceptual cognition gives us an intermediate zone corresponding to the antastara. Whereas perceptual cognition gives us particulars, a tree, which is uniquely a tree. Conceptual cognition can give us universals, said that is the conception of three nets under which there is a potential infinity of trees. But above that, there is imperceptible cognition that gives us the assurance and security, which is the goal of the religious way, and corresponds to the nirvana state of consciousness, a state of complete assurance and grace. And above this lies the pure consciousness from which both all selves and all worlds are derived and correspond to the just, to para nirvana. That covers the subject of this course this morning.